Hello, and welcome to the Wokus Podcast. We're recording live at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts. Today I have with me some of our Crawford Award winners who have all given a reading bravely and most wonderfully at 8:30 in the morning. And so we have today Genevieve Valentine. Genevieve, can you say hi?
Hi.
And we have Chris Barzak.
Hello.
And we have Jed Berry.
Hello.
And so I guess it sounded like your reading went well. You actually had people at 8:30 in the morning. Congratulations.
They were all awake.
It's surprising.
They had smart questions. And
yay,
they
smart questions.
Seemed attentive, or at least put on good attentive faces. It was very nice.
Excellent.
They clapped in all the right places.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Did they laugh in all the right places, or were you reading anything that
there
had
was a remarkable amount of laughter for 8:30 in the morning on Saturday.
Good.
I think both Jed and Chris's stories had humorous elements. They seemed to go over pretty well for people as tired as we all were.
Yes, and again, this is the Saturday that we're recording, and you know, by the Saturday of almost any con, we're just like, whoa. So you guys all in the past 5 years have won one Crawford Awards, I believe.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Chris, and you were last year.
2012.
Right, and Jed, you were.
2010.
Right.
I think. It was 2008.
Yeah. And
Chris is the elder statesman.
We wrestled it away from him.
Yes.
We wrested the mantle from his head, shoulders. So the Crawford Award, for those who don't know, is specifically for a debut work of fantasy, and that's either a short story collection or a novel. And it's you know, it's really meant to sort of encourage people who are coming into the field to let them know about this conference, and also just to say, yes, what you're doing is good, and you should keep doing things like that. And so I have to ask you guys, you know, has it worked? I mean, did you?
It has. You should really just do away with this award. Because it did encourage me. I just kept on writing. But it did. I mean, I think that coming out with your first book is really... It's a scary thing, you know. It's even different from publishing short stories, and because it's a bigger audience. And I know I was fretting when my first book came out, and was worried if people would like me.
Sure.
So when I got that award, it was very confirming or affirming in some way that even if not everyone liked me, some people did. So keep going, you know.
Yeah. I think for me, I mean, it was such a huge honor, and you know, getting that phone call. I was on the side of the road driving somewhere, and I was like, why am I getting this call from Chicago? And it turned out to be Gary Wolf, and that was, you know, it was so thrilling. But for me, one of the exciting things about it also was just that my book had been put out there. The publisher did a great job of kind of connecting to mystery readers, I think, and as someone who is often writing between genres and mixing genres, having the book win the Crawford Award really felt like coming home in some way. Like this to me was, these were the people I was writing for, and who at least would understand what I was really up to, and so that was really fulfilling and helpful to know that the thing hadn't just dropped into an abyss and never landed. somebody heard it.
I actually had the same reaction to the phone call. Gary called me and he was like, do you know what the Crawford Award is? And I was like, yes, of course, what's up?
Do you help?
But no, I think it's very much the thing where when you publish a novel, when you publish a short story, you're part of the history of whatever venue has published your short story, and it feels really good. When you publish a novel, it's like, oh, here we go. Okay, this is the thing. And when you're doing something that's more non-traditional, you do have that feeling where if it falls between the cracks, you're like, well, goodbye. And I think that the Crawford Award actually helped me more once I got to ICFA, because being around, I don't have any academic background. I have an undergraduate, and then I left, and I've never gone back to academia. And being around a bunch of academics who were super enthusiastic about fantasy and about adaptations and transformations and how can we tell stories in a different way, I left super excited. I was like, yes, this is exactly what I want to be doing for the rest of my life.
Awesome.
So it was incredibly formative, I think, being here as much as winning the award in the abstract.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, because ICFA really is this odd an odd mix of academics and writers. Everyone here cares really passionately about this field, and yeah, there's always a big lull in my convention going from World Fantasy to ICFA, and actually this year the last con I went to was ReaderCon because just life happened and I didn't make it to WorldCon or World Fantasy, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're like, oh my goodness, everything is just so much work. Why am I doing this again? Then you come here and you're like, that's right, this is why I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. So again, it's really great that you guys have been able to come back too to the conference, and it seems like a lot of Crawford Award winners have found that valuable and have kept coming.
I really like it because it is both academics and writers, and that like I don't go to a lot of conferences where that kind of mix, you know, happens, and I think it's really cool that, you know, there are, you know, literary critics and scholars that actually do want to know what the writer thinks about their own work.
I find that both interesting and sort of incredibly scary.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, we're going to have a series of papers presented about Neil Gaiman, and then response from Neil Gaiman. It's like, how can you write that paper knowing he's going to be sitting there like, are you sure that's
right? Exactly. No, there's a conference at my university where I teach that I teach creative writing, so I don't, you know, dabble in the criticism, the scholarly aspect of it that much. But there was a conference for working class writing that we used to have at my university, and the writer Tilly Olson came one year, and so it was all about Tilly Olson. And one of my colleagues had written, she gave a paper at that conference about Tilly Olson's Yanandio, and explicated it, kind of a thing. And Tilly Olson at the end of the presentation raised her hand, you know, for Q&A, and she's like, that's a fascinating lecture, but that is not what I meant at all. And my colleague said, I will never give a paper about a living writer again.
Well, certainly not a writer present in the same room.
Right. Like,
actually, one time I was giving a paper, I had been doing a lot of research on Greg Egan, so I'm set. He's mm-hmm. he's in Australia. No one's seen him for decades. So
that's right.
Yeah, no problem there. But I think it was Joe Haldeman. The other two papers were on Joe Haldeman, and Joe is a regular at this conference, and so he came, and he was sitting in the front row, and he spent the entire time sitting back with his arms crossed across his chest, with a vaguely disapproving look on his face. And actually, it turned out he was fine. He was fine with everything. But yeah, he just looked slightly grumpy the whole time. And he didn't react to anything. He didn't laugh. He didn't smile. He didn't nod. I was like, I was getting nervous for the other two
people.
That
was just tough love. He's like, if you really want to examine it, you can examine it with me right here. Make faces at you.
I had an interesting experience this year being on a panel about Kitch Johnson's work, which you know, I'm a huge fan of her work, and I was the only non-academic on the panel. I was like the writer person, and it was an interesting experience because I was reading and rereading her work in these last couple of weeks and trying to figure out, well, you know, what can I bring to this? You know, how can I talk about craft maybe in such a way that, you know, is in my language and which hopefully will not be completely wrong when she has her chance to respond. And I did find myself looking over at her as I was talking just to see, is she nodding? Is she smiling? Is she frowning? But it seemed to go pretty well. And actually, what I found, much to my delight, was that there was a lot of overlap with some of the more academic presentations that we had slightly different languages, but we were getting at some of the same mm-hmm. things, you know, and we were talking about, maybe I would call it point of view, you know, and that this it really added up to something greater than its parts, and it's something I'd love to do again now.
Cool. Now, you guys do both teach, but I guess you teach more creative writing?
I teach creative writing at the University of Massachusetts. I'm a visiting faculty member, so I'd love to keep teaching, but I also love editing, and so considering the possibility of returning to that as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I teach creative writing only in the Northeast Ohio MFA program at Youngstown State University, and but I also dabble with editing a little bit, so actually just gearing up to release first issue of Inner Fictions online in this coming May.
Right. Cool.
I'm co-editing the fiction section of that with Megan McCarron, and because I like doing editing a lot too, it's kind of cool to be the person to select. But
no, not at all.
No,
really.
Maybe in the far future we will see, but right now, I think my editing brain goes into my nonfiction mostly. So when I want to select things, I'm like, I will select this film and this film, and then I shall talk.
Right.
I admire fiction editing because it is like alchemy almost.
Yeah, it's a different process. Yeah, I think.
But yeah, I have to admit that nowadays I read nonfiction to relax. Because whenever I read fiction, the critic brain is just always going. Like, I can't not be analyzing it as I'm reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay, I need to relax now. Nonfiction, let's have a nice memoir. I don't expect that anyone's been giving papers on your guys' work yet.
Not that I know of, but...
Usually it takes a few...
I know people have written about it. You know, written
reviews,
literary criticism. No, beyond that. People
oh, really?
Yeah, it's stuff that shows up in academic journals, you know, or they've included at least my first book. And then, yeah, my second one was written about in a... John Crowley wrote an essay in Tin House about the new ghost.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and he talked about my second book, The Love We Share Without Knowing, in that article, as an example of, like, world ghost literature. I don't think anybody has given presentations of it, like, you know, in person at these things that I know of.
Well, when they do, will you go and cross your arms and make a face?
I will. I will look very disapproving. That's not what I meant at all.
But I was just wondering if you know, being in this kind of atmosphere ever gives you different perspectives on your own work. Make you think about you know, either the craft or themes or the history of the field maybe a little differently?
It has for me. When I went last year, I went to a couple of academic panels, and it actually was a relief to realize how much of academia is documenting the search for something rather than coming in and being like, here is a conclusion, and this is my supporting evidence, and we are done, goodbye. And it made me feel a lot better about a lot of the ways I try to analyze film and whatever else, that it is okay to write about the process of trying to figure out what is happening without having to have a definitive conclusion that wraps up the entire subject forever, the end. And I think that an academic would be listening to this going, yes, of course. But I've never been one. And so for me, I was sitting there going, oh, no, this is fantastic. This is great. Mm-hmm. I want to do more of this.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
It's worked for me. I always feel like I get a new perspective on my work, but also just on how to read in different ways that aren't necessarily my natural process for reading. I was interested in that stuff, I think, from a fairly young age, just as an English major. You know, the university where I went to school didn't really push like theory or lit crit on us. But I was interested just on my own because I felt like I should know. Yeah. I spent a lot of time reading literary criticism on my own and just going to the university library and taking out journals and looking at it. And I felt like, you know, this was a long time ago, like before I was just sort of like trying to figure out how to write. And I felt like reading scholars writing about literature that I'd read they were able to illuminate and elucidate aspects of a book or a story that I had not seen on my own until they provided a language for it. So for me, it was always like it was coming here was like doing that on my own. It was great because it gives that kind of community of that happening rather than just, you know, reading it in the stacks on my own.
Mm-hmm. But, I think that sense of exploration that Genevieve mentioned is something I really identify with, and I think what I often look for from conferences like this, well, there's no conference like this exactly, but what I leave with is like a broader feeling of having been given permission to do what I want to do and to actually like range more widely and experiment more and try out more things. It's just a feeling of, okay, yeah, that, you know, this conversation is really broad and really varied, and it's that feeling of just being kind of released. Go do what you will, and we'll find some way to talk about it.
Yeah, some authors, it's really a stretch sometimes to find the right language to talk about their work.
Yeah, for sure.
So everyone here has written short fiction and done some editing for you guys. Short fiction and novels. I believe you all won the Crawford for novels.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So how big a leap is that to go from short stories to novels? Is it, you know, is it like, oh, okay, now I have done this and it's just more, or is it a completely different?
I think it's more condensed. I feel like it's a literary version of a movie sort of irising in. You can do an entire short story around a single image, a single person, a single moment in time. And it is about examining that in as resonant a way as you can, whatever that is. And then a novel is more like we are taking a movie, we have many thematic elements, probably you're going to have more characters than in your general short story, and then you are trying to talk about something, not necessarily what even the plot is about or what the characters are actually saying, but you're talking about something at length and trying to discover as much of that as you can. The process of writing them, I think, is not very different, just because I have the same problem spots in both.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize, you know, I get to the point and I'm like, oh, no, okay, yeah, I know this one.
Oh.
But the scope is definitely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think moving from short fiction to novels, there's a certain number of things that they do differently. Like, when I moved from writing short fiction exclusively into writing novels, one of the things that I had to figure out that was different was pacing. It was just, the novel is it's a long creature. And you can't pace it the same way that you pace a short story where things move along at the speed of a sentence sometimes, as opposed to the novel. I think, you know, the way that I found, at least, how the pacing for me works in the novel is more in the passage, or, you know, the multiple paragraphs that make up a passage as a movement instead of the individual words in a line. So that was one of the things that was different for me to figure out. And I think even to some extent, just the language use, I felt like I had to loosen up in writing a novel as opposed to short story. I felt like everything's really tightly constructed, kind of a thing. And you know, these are metaphors, but it's how it felt, you know, was a very controlled thing with short stories. And then moving into the novel was opening up instead, unpacking things as I go, rather than closing doors as I move along in a short story, saying, we're not going to go in there. We might suggest what's behind that door, but we're not going to go into that room. Yeah, so we got to get to the end here. Yeah. So that was different for me. And I think every novel is, at least I know other people have said this, every novel for me has been different in trying to figure out how to write that novel. They all present their own problems.
Mm-hmm. I'm balancing a number of projects right now, some short stories and a novel. And one thing I'm noticing is that the short stories seemed to be informing the novel more and more. It seems as though that in these shorter works, I'm having the chance to play with some new ideas and push certain boundaries of my own, you know, kind of just things that I've run up against in the past, and now I'm just trying to kind of break rules that I've set for myself. And it's actually turned into a really nice circular process at this point, where I maybe take slightly bigger risks in the stories, and then those risks are really informing what I can do in the novel that I'm working on. And obviously, there's an interplay of ideas. You know, I realize every once in a while that, oh, there's something I'm obsessed with, apparently, because there it is again. Someone pointed out to me recently that I seem to have this pattern of men in my stories and novel who who have one injured hand or missing hand. And I was like, I did not even see that, and yet I've done it like 3 times in the last year, so something's going on there. So I love too, just kind of tracking these little image sets.
Do you change that when you find it, or do you kind of lean into it? And
oh,
like,
I go for
everyone,
it.
Everyone,
yes.
Has
a- yes, because when someone writes a paper on my work, they're going to love this.
There's a life motif here.
There's a whole dissertation in that.
Exactly.
Actually, I remember when I was doing the Egan research, I was doing all the reading for it. One thing that, and I don't have the guts to ask me about it, a significant number of his male protagonists are named Martin.
Huh.
It just shows Martin. Up over and over. It's like either the protagonist is or a significant side character is.
I remember Maureen McHugh saying that she always had, like, I think it was like female protagonists that their names started with like the letter E or something like that, and she recognized that like after she'd written like 5 books or something like that. She was like, oh, these women have the same first letter.
Well, and you like to think it's deeply symbolic.
It's not.
And sometimes it is. Sometimes you sit down with like a name dictionary. And you're like, I need a name that means, strength in the rain. But sometimes you're like, I like the name Tom.
Yeah.
And then you realize a year later that you've written 18 things, all of which have Tom in them. And you're like, sorry, everybody.
Somebody's going to try to make sense of that.
One of the things that came up in the interview with Kidge Johnson was playing with formalism or form and structure, and several of her stories are she talked about deconstructing the story into this kind of the smallest units and then messing with them and seeing how much you can mess with it and still have a story that's
mm-hmm.
effective. And Jed, you pulled out you had these little cards.
Right, I actually read from that this morning, and I was so excited because what Kidge Johnson mentioned in that interview was that her work, her story kit, had actually begun as a series of cards, and that she was playing with these bits and pieces and arranging and rearranging them. And this is something I've been playing with for a while, and the story that I'm working on that I'm still kind of adding pieces to is kind of a gothic family tale, but it is a deck of cards that gets shuffled and read in a random order each time, and this kind of formal play is interesting to me in part because it just draws attention to how narrative works. I mean, you have these echoes that might pop up in one part or another, and you realize that gives the feeling of narrative even when you haven't kind of laid it out point by point. And I feel like with Kidge's work, I mean, and she said this herself, that she's been experimenting more recently. A story like Mantis Wives, which I think was just out
in Clark's World,
mm-hmm. Right. Where she's playing with vignettes or playing a kind of formal game, which really... There's real heart and emotion in it, and I feel like sometimes this stuff gets pushed aside, and people say, well, you're just toying around, like there isn't a real story here. But in her hands, certainly, like I feel like a serious emotional commitment to the underlying parts of the story, and so I was thrilled to hear that she's been toying with that. I may have even gotten her to say that she's going to write a deck of cards. So that little project of mine maybe will expand into some sort of publishing venture eventually.
That could be cool.
That would be
yeah.
amazing.
I'd really, yeah, if I can either, kickstart something or convince some, I don't know, some small independent publisher to give me an imprint of my own. We'll see. We'll see.
I wonder who we know who works for a small independent publisher. Now, Chris and Genevieve, has that ever been something you've been tempted to play with, or
formalism? I go back and forth. There's specific stories that I've written that if they felt like a lot of times I move into formalism when I feel like telling a story sort of traditionally there's something that isn't resonating for me with it, and then I try to figure out how to basically break it up, like to bust it into pieces and see like what can I see once it's actually no longer this cohesive whole that I'd built, which is like this tendency to want to create a kind of cohesive whole. And sometimes I have to to pull back and figure out some kind of other container or format for it that is that pleases me. One of the stories that I did that with was it was also a gothic story, family story, called What We Know About the Lost Families of Blank House. Blank is not really in the title, it's just a line. that gothic tradition of not naming particular yes. homes and things like that, and it's protecting their identities, but or something horrible happened. But yeah, it's a story that was about like three different generations, or not generations, three different families over a period of a century, and this doom that befalls each family in this haunted house. I was writing that story initially fairly literally and had all these passages of basically the narrative of each of these three different families, and it all felt like everything that I made was I was happy with on the level of like the line in the story, but I wasn't happy with the shape. And one of the things that I ended up doing to make, you know, everything for me in the process, it starts out with just pleasing myself, and so I ended up cutting up the story into pieces and arranging them on the floor in different spots, and so there's this back and forth between the different families. You don't get everything all at once, and in some ways you have to keep track of the different family lineages and stuff like that, and it created a kind of energy and a tension between all of those pieces that wasn't there when it was all laid out linearly, and so it becomes it's a more modularized story, but unlike Jed's story that he read today, which I love that format with the card and how it can all mix up, so you know, each time it's a different kind of story. It's kind of like that, but it's frozen still in its final form in the way that it's read. But now I want to play around with your idea.
He pulls out cards and I was like, you dastardly genius.
Yes, yes.
And Genevieve, so you've done some of the same?
Oh, yes. My first novel was first person, second person, third person, past, present, and future tense, mixed up in a way that begins sort of indiscriminately, and then we sort of start pulling toward a cohesive whole, but definitely a non-linear narrative is one of my favorites. I love when it's non-linear. Recently I have started playing more with the idea of creating a story in the absences between things that don't seem like they initially relate. So I did a steampunk story a while ago, the Zeppelin Conductor Society Annual Gentleman's Ball, most of which was someone's memoirs, but leaving out huge swaths of things, because of course someone telling a memoir is telling a very tight story. And I intercut it with imaginary advertisements, imaginary PSAs, news clippings, that kind of thing. And it's something that I really liked and recently returned to in another Victorian story that is coming out in Queen Victoria's Book of Spells next week, I think. And they wanted fantasy, but not necessarily steampunk. And I was desperate to talk about the Great Exhibition of 1851, which is often touted as, you know, a beautiful sort of museum experience, and it's wonderful and great. But when you look at the catalog of it, it was an exhibit of the economies of all nations, starring England, basically.
Yes.
And you realize it's a huge national. You know, it was an economic decision. It was a nationalist decision.
Yeah.
The rhetoric around it gets kind of frightening. And the more I did research into it, the more I was setting stuff aside, like, I have to find a way to use this. And finally I had a pile of stuff, and I was like, I am just using this pile of stuff. So the story has a fake semi-academic article, and it obviously includes some fantasy elements that weren't there, but there are quite a few things from it that were from history, because you couldn't make up the amount of fervor that was going on around this particular event. And I like the idea of slightly fictionalizing something that is real in order to highlight the fantastic elements of what was real to begin with. And in this case, it was cultish. It was a cultish thing. And the more I do, the more I really enjoy doing it. There are definitely some stories where it starts with a character, and you're like, nope, this is about the character. Like, I'm going to tell the story as close to this character that I love and want to hold in my arms and make okay as possible. But I think that there are some ideas where you want to sit down and be like, okay, let's talk about the idea of this. Here's how we're going to do it.
Yeah. And I heard you read from that last night and really enjoyed it. And the thing that struck me is that there was so much also in that exhibition that was deeply strange. Like, some of the material that was actually there. I hope I have this right. Maybe you can tell me. Okay. I believe maybe in the Germany exhibit there was like a little tableau of stuffed frogs who yep. were in a barber shop scene, yep. like one is shaving the other. Crazy stuff, which sounds like pure fantasy. Right. And so I love what you're doing with it, because you're creating all of these real seeming texts and playing with the idea of what's real and what's not. And already the source material is so deeply weird. Yeah.
The Britain booth also had over 100 kinds of rope. So it was an entire room full of sections of rope that you were supposed to wander through and be like, the glory of Britain!
Yes, yes.
I'm sure that was a big hit with the kids. Look, Mommy.
And it was such an influential thing, even in its absurdity. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful thing in some ways, but there's definitely aspects of it where you're like, wait, back up. What? There was the perfume fountain. The Swiss had a perfume fountain, and you could dip your handkerchief into it and walk away with free Swiss perfume. And so many people considered it worth the price of admission, because you could basically steal a cup of perfume and run out. It was an interesting time, 1851.
Yeah.
So when it comes to doing research, I mean, it sounds like you did an amazing amount of research for that, you know, on that topic, you know, for that story. Do you do that often? I mean, is that like something that's like part of your favorite part of the job, or
you want to go on the record being like, yes, always? It's painstaking. Probably never enough research. Like, let's just be perfectly honest. Mm. You can always be doing more research. Mm-hmm. There are definitely times where I feel like it is my responsibility to do research, and I take that very seriously. I recently wrote a story set in a Weird West, and it was trying to be as truthful as possible to the depiction of the treatment of various indigenous and immigrant groups. And so, of course, a story like that, there's a lot of responsibility. There is a lot of research. You want to make sure that you are as accurate as possible and as honest as possible. For historical stuff, you definitely want to make sure you're not making any glaring mistakes. Like, if this accidentally took place in 1857, it's going to be very embarrassing for everyone. But I do think that at some point the research becomes, let's avoid making any errors that would draw people out of the story. Mm-hmm. And then once you have a platform you can stand on, you can do whatever magic you feel like. You just need to make sure that your platform's not going to collapse under mm-hmm. you. So I would say whatever that platform is, and however strong it needs to be for the magic you want to do, that is the amount of research that you have to do. Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on what I'm working on. Some things require research. Other things, I don't feel like I'm working with a particular kind of material that is recordable and disputable.
Right.
But with the things that are, like, even I'm thinking about when I was going through the process of writing my second book, The Love We Share Without Knowing, that book, I wrote that when I was living in Japan. And so there's a wide cast of characters in it, some Japanese, some... an international community, basically, of expats are in the book, too. One of the things that I wanted to do as I was writing that book and sort of thinking about it was I wanted to kind of, in some ways, just conjure the flavor or feeling of the Japan's folklore and myth, or their concept of the supernatural, but in a modern day setting. And I felt like beyond what I was doing, just to situate myself in Japanese culture itself, which was like learning the language and trying to, you know, take myself into as many different corners of its socioeconomic stratums and cities and rural villages and things like that, was to also immerse myself in their literature, their film, texts like Lafcadio Hearn's Kwaidan, which were basically translations of original Japanese sort of ghost stories, bakemono, you know, monster stories and things like that. So that I felt like that was research for me. It was to kind of get the feeling of the way that the stories were told and how the supernatural felt in the stories and how it was dealt with in that culture, and to also place that up against foreigners encountering that in a different culture than they're used to, and to sort of have that interplay of perspective on how folklore works in a different culture. So things like that became important to me as I was writing that book. I remember watching Akira Kurosawa's Dreams for the first time, which is this really beautiful film that it's just these vignettes that are literally Akira Kurosawa's dreams, it feels like, you know. Tiny little stories that incorporate like little, you know, like the fox folklore into it, but into a very ordinary peasant boy's life, you know. So it's like something really mythic with something very ordinary and familiar within Japanese culture sort of colliding and being handled so delicately is different from the kind of handling that I see that, you know, of the supernatural or fantastical in Western literature. I don't see it in Western literature. It always feels like it's like much more direct, and in Japanese literature, I feel like the supernatural always sort of comes in from the side and then completely overwhelms, kind of thing. So it's very there's a frightening quality that I found in encountering the structure and the handling of their myths and folklore. That was something about uncertainty and then being overwhelmed, kind of thing. And so I was trying to capture all of that. And that was the kind of research that I did, was sort of immersing myself in that and trying to understand and grapple with it in that way. Even though the stories that I was telling in that book were original stories rather than based on a particular event or time period or anything like that.
Research. I feel like increasingly I've been writing in not real versions of real places, like kind of dreamed versions of places, which I'm not doing to avoid research necessarily, but it does change my relationship.
It does, but
what I do find is that I need the particulars to work correctly. In the novel I'm working on right now, actually, most of it takes place on a train, and I mean the world beyond that is deeply strange. There are ghosts and there are dreams on the loose and all other kinds of weirdnesses, but the train needs to work right. And so I have a train guy. I have somebody who I can turn to with my train questions, and that's important, because I feel like if I can get that engine running correctly, then the rest hopefully will be permitted. And then I guess I should say there is this other project that I have that I've been researching for like 10 years, which is it's the novel I keep not writing because I don't feel quite ready for it yet. And that will be, you know, a historical novel. And I'm getting closer, but I'm still building out my knowledge of, you know, Revolutionary War era New York State. And once I have it all in my head, accessible as I need it, then I'll start writing.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Okay, well, we should probably wrap up, but I want to thank you guys so much for coming. I'd also like to ask you, as a sort of a finale, what you're working on now and what you've got coming out. So, Genevieve?
My next novel is a historical novel, speaking of research. Which is a retelling of the 12 Dancing Princesses set in 1927 New York.
I just actually released my first full-length collection of short stories, sort of from the first 10 years of my life as a writer. It's called Before and After Lives. Right now I'm working on a novel that I'm getting very close to finishing called Wonders of the Invisible World. Which I've been working on for like 4 or 5 years now.
You can do it. I believe in you.
I'm just like, one more draft. And I have a movie's being made of my first novel, One for Sorrow, but the movie is going to be called Jamie Marks is Dead, and it's shooting right now in upstate New York and should be released in the winter of 2014.
Cool.
Wow, that's so exciting.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Liv Tyler's in it.
Are you over it yet, or are you just never over
it? I'm waiting to get over it. I'm going through it.
we were talking about this earlier, and I love that they're filming in upstate New York, and you know, the area that I grew up in is apparent, you know, is a good enough stand-in for the area you grew up in.
Yeah.
And that they're, yeah, this is a
rural, really cool, post-industrial towns.
Exactly. Yeah, that's great. I have a long story, maybe novelette, coming out at Tor.com this summer. Ellen Datlow picked it up. It's called A Window or a Small Box. And I'm working on this novel, which I hope to finish this year, and I'm also working on a number of stories that the genre I like, I've come up with is sword and sorcibility. it's kind of like Robert E. Howard meets Jane Austen or something. There's a barbarian warrior in a sort of pseudo Victorian London, and hijinks ensue.
Okay, well, we look forward to all of that. And again, thank you so much for taking time out of your conference to come and talk with us.
Thank you.